From 104.5 The Zone, an hour of talk about sports, Nashville, and more with Ned Michaels and Bob Mueller. Phone lines are open at 615-737-1045. This is Michaels and Mueller, presented by Franklin American Mortgage Company on 104.5 The Zone.
All right, everyone, good evening. This is Michaels and Mueller. Well, kind of. I'm Barney Aller. I'm the head golf instructor at the Old Hickory Country Club, and I'm joined in studio by my good buddy Chris Sanders, the 2018 recipient of the Nicest Guy of the Year Award. Chris, welcome in.
Hey, how you doing, man? You doing all right?
I'm doing great, and thank you so much again for being a part of the show.
Oh, man, you're welcome. Are you recovered from that Masters yet?
Isn't that something? And so, folks, that is only a fraction of what we're going to talk about in this evening's show. In addition to that, did anyone bother to happen to notice the draft is coming right up?
When is it?
And it's going to be next week, and it's going to be in our gorgeous, beautiful city, and there's going to be hundreds of thousands of people, that are coming in, and our very own Nashville Predators.
Woo! Man, that was a great game yesterday.
Thank goodness they turned it around, because boy, was everyone nervous the way they lost the first game. And so, folks, we want you to be a part of the show this evening. Again, as always, you control where the discussion goes. You can give us a call at 615-737-1045. That's 615-737-1045. But where we're going to start is with the Masters kind of, I don't know if he's the better half or one of the halves of Michaels and Mueller, but Ned Michaels was actually on site the digital broadcast at Augusta. Mm. He joins us now. Ned, welcome in and tell us about that Masters.
Gentlemen.
Come on, man. Talk to me. Talk to me.
Amazing. It was epic, historic. Any word that you can think of, I'm out of superlatives, but he did it. And Barney, I'm not sure anybody ever thought that he could. Certainly not Ryan A. Mudd. Ryan A. Mudd never thought he was going to make it. But I had the opportunity, Barney, after we were done with our work on 15 and 16, to climb the hill and get under the tower right where Jim Nantz and Nick Faldo were, and stood there and watched the event unfold as Koepka missed his putt. And then they posted Tiger's par on 17. And then as he made his way up, you know, it was still, we couldn't believe it until the final putt had dropped. But to be able to watch it right in front of us and see his family and the fans, the chant, the Tiger, Tiger, it was palpable. I mean, tears, people were weeping. It was surreal, to say the least.
You know, when Tiger, you know, realized that he won, you know, let the fans know that his celebration, was it a sigh of relief, or was he happy that he won, or was he just, man, I'm just glad to be in this position once again? What, tell us a little bit about that.
It was all of the above, wasn't it? It's a weird thing when you win a golf tournament. Now, I've never won the Masters, of course, but there's a sense of relief and the excitement and the joy. It doesn't really hit you until kind of the next day or maybe even a day later, because you're grinding so hard. You're so focused. And, you know, they say, oh, it must be fun to win a tournament. I don't know if fun's the right word, because you're so in the moment and you're so engrossed, and it's a stressful situation. And then given the context of Barney, where he's been for the past 3-4 years, that Tiger roar was an exhale that included the satisfaction of winning, the joy of being a major champion again, and then overcoming all the obstacles that he has.
But, you know, I was in the gym. You know, we work at the same YMCA because, you know, we're both big guys. But, you know, when I walked in the gym, there was an old lady that came up to me, and she was almost in tears, and she said this. She said, I was so happy that Tiger won. See, I know everybody's talking about the golf, but I think everybody was excited because all the stuff that he went through, you know, and all the mistakes that he made. And he could have quit. So I think that he just identifies with so many people. And I just think that that's why everybody was excited that he won.
Right. For a while, he has been seen as a tragic hero in that he had all the skill sets and he had life by the tail and he let it get away. He dropped the ball. And all of a sudden, he starts just little bit by little bit. I mean, it's taken years now for him to get his personal life 11. Where he needed it, right? Where his kids were there. His mom was there. And then he started to get his body a little bit better piece by piece. And I mean, 2 years ago, he wasn't worried about winning a tournament. He was worried about ever walking again.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And so as human beings, we naturally want to pull for this guy. And so just from the golf standpoint and what he's come through physically is incredible. But then when you put in the context of everything that's happened in his personal life and, of course, playing out in the public, I think it probably exponentially increases the accomplishment.
So, Ned, you've had 2 days to reflect on the historical context of somewhat being, I guess, maybe one of the best comebacks, not just in golf, but in all of sports. And when that question was actually thrown out there on Twitter, for instance, I think a lot of people kind of misinterpreted the question because, for instance, a lot of people were talking about, like, let's say the Red Sox coming back after a 3-game deficit in the American League Series against the Yankees. No. I don't think we're talking about a comeback of that nature, because to me, that would be something like he shot 4 under in the last 7 holes. This, to me, would be a comeback like Brett Favre coming out of retirement and leading a team to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I mean, I would give you Ben Hogan in golf. The man got hit head-on by a Greyhound bus and basically had his legs and pelvis shattered. Oh, and he came back within 20 months and won the U.S. Open. So I might give you that. That one maybe didn't have all the emotional and psychological connotations to go with it. So when I look at this, Barney, I'm trying to separate just from the athletic standpoint. Mm-hmm. Set aside all the psychology. Set aside whether you no longer like Tiger because of everything that was happening off the golf course. Are you disappointed? Set aside all of that. I'm just looking at it from the context of a sporting event, a comeback as an athlete. And Barney, he literally could not get out of his chair, couldn't get out of his car to get his kids from school. Mm-hmm. He couldn't go to the refrigerator, Chris. I mean, you've been there. You know, when you have back pain and you have lived this.
That ended my career.
You have lived it. Ended your career. Wow. Imagine if 17 years later, you came back and set the all-time receiving record in the NFL.
I might see you trying to make me come out of retirement. Man. Come on, don't do it, Ed. Don't do it, Ned. Don't do it. I almost came out of retirement.
I believe in you. I got your back. You know, I don't have your bunion though.
Hey, just kind of looking at Tiger, what did he do different? Was it his short game? Was it putting? Was it his driver? What was the difference from 2 years ago into now?
Well, first of all, he hit the most greens of anybody in the field at the Masters. And in order to win the Masters, you have to hit a lot of greens. And statistically, we know this. He hit more than anybody else. He had 81% of his greens. So that's a start. Mm-hmm. And then he just methodically dissected the golf course. Ooh. He let it come to him. He wasn't worried about the putts that he was missing early in the tournament. He understood the value of being on the right position on the green. He didn't ever try to overpower the golf course. You look at the last day on 12, for example, it goes to the center of the green. Of course, for the last 6 players that hit it in the water, so that was the right play. 15, he goes to the center of the green. He thought better than anybody else. He hit more greens than anybody else. In the last day, he did not miss a single putt inside of 10 feet, and that's how you win the Masters.
Mm. And so, Ned, in addition to that, how many Masters have you been a part of at this point now?
Well, in terms of the broadcast team now, Barney, it's been 5 or 6 years. 2 years I was doing the kind of background stats work, and then 3 years, I guess, it's now been actually on the call. But, of course, I used to come to the Masters as a kid growing up in Atlanta with my dad. So I have all these wonderful memories of driving down, and, you know, where the old parking lot used to be is now the practice area. And there used to be a couple of mounds to the right of 15 green. You could stand on the mound. I could get on my dad's shoulders, and I could see 16 green and 15 green. So I have a lifetime of memories from that place.
But Ned, when it comes to this Masters, what a lot of people fail to realize is that if Elvis Presley would have played golf, this is what it would have been like. If the Beatles would have played golf, I think this is what it would have been like. And with your experience of having been there in the past, I have to believe almost even as soon as Monday, but for sure Thursday, then Friday, then Saturday, then Sunday, that the vibe and the electricity in the air had to have been something the likes of which you have never been a part of or witnessed.
No. And I'll tell you this, 1997, I was at the Masters with my dad, and Tiger had it wrapped up. So we were headed up the hill, and there were 20 deep on each side of 18. From the fairway all the way to the green. So we're just going to head back to the car, and all of a sudden this ball comes bouncing by our feet, and it comes to rest, and it's Tiger's ball. Remember, in 97, he pulled it way left and over those bunkers. So I'm the first one there. And so I'm standing there. Fluff puts the bag down right in front of me. He and Tiger, I could have reached out and tapped Tiger on the shoulder. You know, he hits the shot, and everybody's going crazy. So when I say I was there, I literally, if you see the pictures, I'm there in my Nike cap, you know, like just kind of drooling on his golf ball kind of deal. So I remember those emotions, and I was there under the tower watching it unfold. And very different, because in 97 it was, here comes Tiger. Mm-hmm. This is the coronation. This is the young man who's now getting ready to carry the torch for the game of golf. And this past week, it was, now I'm a father, and my son is watching Tiger do it, and he's being inspired by Tiger. So it's two generations deep now that have been inspired by Tiger and his play at the Masters. And when he comes off the green on 18, everybody there was cheering for Tiger.
Wow.
And Barney, it started early, and Chris, it started early. We had major champions, and it was thick and frothy on a Thursday. You looked at the leaderboard. It was everybody who we thought was playing well, except for Justin Rose. We can talk about that tomorrow night, Barney. Totally different deal.
That's right.
Everybody was there.
Yeah.
And then they stayed there. Everybody was playing well, and you knew they weren't coming back. It was you could not have scripted this. Even if you were writing it and had spent 11 years writing it, it was perfect.
Yeah. You know, we always hear this quote. It says, attitude determines altitude. Do you think the reason why he's soaring so high right now is because his attitude is totally different 2 years as opposed to now?
Yes. And I think it's a lot of things, Chris. The culmination of the mental side, the psychology of it. And this is just my interpretation of quotes that I've read and press conferences that I've watched. I certainly have not talked to Tiger. But in a way, he's thought about what he's done in the past. He's a better man for it. Ooh,
that makes a difference.
Makes a huge difference. Yeah. The ability to forgive yourself and then become better.
Whoa, Ned, say that again. to what?
The ability to forgive yourself.
You know, and it's funny because I was listening to some people on the radio saying that, oh, this guy has won championships and all that, but he's still a bad guy. I mean, we're so quick not to forgive. But then you said the key words, long as he forgives himself, that's all that matters. Because if he can forgive himself, then now he can be a better man. He can be a better father. He can be better in all the relationships. And I just think that if he can forgive himself, man, he can still do some great things away from golf.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Well, unbelievable.
And again, I'm taking excerpts from articles and extrapolating what basically I'm reading, what he's saying, but he wants to be a better man. And then, Chris, you know, when you have been laid up from injury as a professional athlete, physically, obviously, it's a challenge, but emotionally, it takes such a heavy toll on who you are. It affects your being, your soul. And for him not to be able to get out of bed, for you, for example, not to be able to use your left leg, I mean, it is an emotional mountain to overcome as much as it is a physical one. And so now the straight jubilation and joy of being able to compete again, that's what he was all about. He just loves the juices of the competition. And so for him, it's this combination, it's this cauldron of the psychological side and now the physical side. And he's back and he loves it and he remembers how much he loves it. And so I think, you know, barring injury, I think we will continue to see him in the mix.
So, Ned, my last question for you for this segment is, when did you know he was going to win?
Oh, yeah, you knew he was going to win on 12, didn't you? When Molinari hit it in the water on 12, after Koepka, after Ian Poulter, you know, four guys in the last six players hit it in the water, and Tiger hadn't hit. So as soon as he hit in the center of 12, he said, probably his. The reason being, he had two par fives to play. The guys who were ahead of him or he was tied with, they were basically done with the par fives. I mean, Shoffley was there, Patrick Cantlay, but he had shot 64, and you knew he was going to fade, just statistically speaking. So I think when he hit the green on 12, he said, it's his to lose. But I still didn't believe it, Barney, until the putt went in the hole on the 18th.
Well, I'll tell you what. You knew at the beginning of the week there was going to be a historical Masters, and sure enough, it is. And folks, the voice you're hearing there is my good friend Ned Michaels.
Hello, Ned.
Who was actually on site at Augusta. And tomorrow evening at the same time at 7 o'clock is going to be Global Golf Radio, hosted by myself with Ned calling in. And we're going to have a lot more Masters conversation. Ned, thanks for joining
us this evening.
Appreciate you, my friend. All right, guys. So good to talk to you.
Yeah, always, bro.
All right, folks, keep it right here. You listen to Michaels and Mueller on 104.5 The Zone. Barry from Columbia, you keep it right there. We're going to get with you as soon as we come back. And then a little more Masters chatter, and then we're going to look into the Preds and a little draft action. So, folks, keep it right here. Listen to Michaels and Mueller on 104.5 The Zone. All right, everyone, welcome back into Michaels and Mueller. Well, sort of, because I'm Barney Allery. I'm the head golf instructor of the Old Hickory Country Club. Joined by my good friend, one of the nicest guys in the world, Mr. Chris Sanders. And thank you, as always, for what Ryan Albanese does for us. And, again, another gorgeous day here in Nashville. The only way it could get better is if we happen to go to visit Mississippi. And that's what Bob Mueller, Ned Michaels, and myself like to do. Yes, and can you blame us when they got gorgeous golf courses like Old Waverly, Mossy Oak, and so many others? They've got world-class seafood. They've got chicken. Oh,
that's the part I like right
there. Seafood, baby.
There we go.
And they've got sports betting. And by any chance, if anyone happened to put a few nickels and dimes on Tiger Woods, guess what? You might have made a little bit of money. And so, folks, all you have to do to go to visit Mississippi is go to www.visitmississippi.org. They can take care of all of your travel needs. And now joining us, we've got Barry from Columbia. Barry, welcome in to Michaels and Mueller.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I'm listening to Ned, and we're talking about Jack, and obviously Jack, you know, obviously he's got the record for the most majors. But let's do a timeline, and I'm going to do it in three phases. The first phase is when Jack Nicklaus was coming up, obviously fighting Arnie. Any major during his early era, there was only probably, I don't know, maybe I'll go out on a limb and say 10. That every time a major was played, only 10 players were capable of winning the major. All right, so fast forward, obviously Jack wins it at 46, which was great. And so now we're getting into today's era of golf, I think a lot of people Tiger inspired a lot of people, and you think about it. So look who he competed against. Well, actually, let me back up. The Ryder Cup, Jack Nicklaus was integral part of forming the Ryder Cup, but yet the U.S. always won. So you think about that. So now fast forward to coming up to today, the Ryder Cup is anybody's game. It's a worldwide game. And look at how many major winners had a chance to win the Masters this past weekend. So Tiger, when he was in his prime, he wouldn't even talk to the press. They had to come out on the putting green to talk to him. And I remember one year at the British Open, they got mad because he went out at 5 o'clock in the morning to play his practice round, and the press was pissed because they're like, "Where's Tiger?" Well, he came out at 5 o'clock and he's already done. And so that was the mindset he was in. He was focused and he was on his own. And then he had the downfalls, the infidelity, and then the health issues. And now he's been humbled. And he's come back. And we saw it last year with the British Open and then the PGA. And then he wins the Tour Championship. And I knew he was capable. And I was proud for him to come back. The main thing, he's come back, he's humbled, and he's got a whole different mindset, but he's still got the game.
Well, Barry, thanks so much for being a part of the show, and there's no question that he's got the game. Yeah. So I can make the argument that if you want to say that the miracle that happened on Sunday, actually, I'm not so sure if the miracle didn't happen last year, because he demonstrated to us a competitive level that, quite honestly, we'd all given up on, that he was ever going to be that good. But then he sure enough showed us at the British Open, like Barry pointed out, the British Open, then at the PGA Championship, and then the Tour Championship. Yeah. No. He is on his way back to being a world-class golfer, and doggone if he doesn't win this past Sunday, the impossible happened on Sunday. So, Barry, thanks for the phone call, and now we're going to turn our attention to Ross from Nashville. Ross, welcome into Michaels and Mueller.
Yeah, I've got a question about Thursday's round. Stenson, I think it was number 13, he hit his ball in the Azaleas, and they've got five or six people looking for his ball, including, I think, Sergio and his caddy and ball spotters and officials. They use their 3 minutes up. Stenson and his caddy grab their bag. They take an obvious 10 or 15 steps back towards the fairway, like he's going to go take a drop out there. And then they call him back. They found the ball, and they let him play an unplayable lie. What is that? Everybody I've talked to says that that was clear indication he had given up on the ball, and he had no choice except to go play from the fairway. So can you explain that?
Ross, thanks for the question. And as far as I know, now again, they've changed the rules here and there, but the idea of giving up on the ball, it's more a function of if the time ran out. And so I did not see the incident that you're talking about, but I'm awfully confident that they had about the most qualified rules people on site to supervise the entire thing. And because going back, let me put it this way, before the internet, going that far back in my competitive past, that again, a similar situation had happened where I've more or less given up on the ball. No. There's no such thing. Once the time runs out, now you're done. You can't, or unless you then proceed and hit another ball and a few other things of that nature, but there's no such a thing as actually giving up on the ball. But I have to believe that the correct rule was implemented. And Ross, thanks for being a part of the show. And now with the few minutes we've got left in this segment, we're going to turn our attention to a little Preds action.
Yeah.
And so folks, in case you missed it, the Preds lost their first game and I was there. It was a late evening game. It was at 8:30, a puck drop. And in fact, they pushed it back because they must have known I was going to be running late. And I'll tell you what, I was exhausted the next day and doggone it, I wanted to see the win, but they lost. But then they turned around and in the second home playoff game, let the record show that Craig Smith gets the playoff goal in overtime. And if he does not score that goal, if they win, and now all of a sudden we would have lost two home games, Chris Sanders, I don't know if that would have been devastating, but I bet it would have been close.
I mean, it's all about attitude. And then, you know, when they lost the first game, your leader started to speak up. They wasn't pointing fingers. They wasn't saying this person needs to do better, that person needs to do better. They collectively said, we have to do better. And that's the sign of a mature team. And when you have a mature team like that, when they go against adversity, when they go up against certain things, they don't backtrack. They say, you know what? We got to focus on what we need to do. We got to make some plays. We got to be physical. We got to skate fast because the Stars skated faster than them in the first game. Mm-hmm. If you look at the game that they played yesterday, they look like a totally different team. They were physical. They were fast. They were hustling after every puck. The first game, we didn't see that. And what we were talking about off air, I think sometimes the pressure is on the team that plays at home.
Because
if you look at the Stars, when they came here, they played with confidence.
Right.
But when they went back home, they looked like they really didn't know what they were doing. Guys were out of place. Guys wasn't hustling on to the puck. And the Predators took advantage of it. They were like a shark in water smelling blood. And that's exactly why they got the win.
And one of the turning points in the game is when the Predators defended the 5-on-3, and Pekka Rinne, who, again, drives us crazy a little bit. I'll tell you what, he had an awfully good game, and when we defended the 5-on-3, the statistics on when you stop the other team from scoring and then relative to if the score is actually made are huge. It swings one way or another, and then I want to get your take just for a minute on, to me, the unsung hero, and maybe he isn't an unsung hero, but Rocco Grimaldi.
Little bitty guy
that amongst all these giants among men.
Sure.
And here's this guy. He has all this energy. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, he is helping run that engine.
Right. I mean, it's like this. Who's the most feared animal in the jungle? It's the lion, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's not the biggest. He's not the fastest. He's not the strongest. He's not even the smartest. But when he steps on the scene, why does everybody fear him? Is because he thinks he is.
That's right.
And that's why it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how big you are. It's not about how tall you are. It's not about how strong you are. But if you think you can accomplish the impossible.
And folks, if you want more Preds chatter coming up later, or I guess after we're all said and done, is going to be the Neutral Zone with Christopher and his brother Darren Martell. And I promise you that they're going to break it down like crazy. But folks, you're listening to Michaels and Mueller. And when we come back, with the NFL draft coming up, I want to hear about my friend Chris Sanders and his NFL draft experience, as well as what he might think that the Titans are going to do. So, folks, keep it right here. You're listening to Michaels and Mueller on 104.5 The Zone. All right, everyone, we march on here on Michaels and Mueller. However, neither Michaels or Mueller here.
We kind of look alike. I want the stash, though. I want the stash.
Speak for yourself on that one. So, folks, I'm Barney Aller. I'm the head golf instructor at the Old Hickory Country Club, joined in studio by my good friend Chris Sanders. And, folks, we want you to be a part of the show. All you have to do is give us a call at 615-737-1045. We've talked Masters, but you know what? We can talk more about it. And then we've talked a little bit about Preds, and then we're about to talk about the NFL draft. But as always, Michaels and Mueller, so proud to be brought to you by Lindell Jewelers. And, you know, I got a feeling that there might be some people out there that, you know, it's been a tough month because, you know, that a lot of people have been trying to watch a lot of basketball and then the Masters. And you know what? Sometimes maybe make the little lady happy. Why don't you?
You better.
And why don't you go ahead and stop into Lindell Jewelers? They're located at 7028 Church Street in Brentwood, Tennessee. And their phone number is 615-373-7922. That's 615-373-7922. Make the little lady happy, why don't you? And go visit Lindell Jewelers. But now, I want to turn my attention to my good friend Chris Sanders. So there's a lot of young college football players that their dream of finally playing in the NFL is about to come true.
Yeah.
And I want you to share with us, what was it like for you coming out of the Ohio State University? What was it like for you?
It was surreal. And you know, we always talk about that when it actually happens, you get emotional because all the things you went through. You know, my first year, I was ineligible. I had to sit out a year. My second year, I got hurt my knee. My third year, I had an okay season. I didn't even have a touchdown yet. I get there my senior year. I ran track the following year, so my coaches got upset, so they didn't start me my senior year. So now I'm going through adversity, so now I'm behind the eight ball. So now we're in my senior season. I get eight touchdowns, and all of a sudden I'm going through the combine. You know, I'm excited about that. I have a good combine. I have a good senior bowl. Then now is draft day. And now the uncertainty of where you're going. Don't know where you're going. If you're going to first round, if you're going to second round, third round, or might not even get drafted. So in 1995, when they called my name, the third round, the 67th pick, it was tears. It was tears of joy. The tears of, just like when we talked about Tiger Woods, all the adversity that you went through and all the pain and all the suffering and all the doubts in your mind that you want, that you actually wanted to quit. And when you actually, when they actually say your name, it's just something that is unexplainable. My mom, my mom was crying with me. She was, because she knows what I went through, and just all the things that led up to that, to know that if I would have quit, I never would have obtained my dream. And that's why I was so overwhelmed.
So you were the 67th overall pick. When did you get contacted that you were about to be coming up next? Was that during when they're announcing the 65th pick, the 66th
pick? Funny story. This is a funny story. I was sitting down and I was watching it, and I actually was in the shower. Then I got out the shower, and you know when they say your name, they walk up to the podium and they say, well, they take Chris Sanders, you know, from the Ohio State University. But the commentators were talking, so they couldn't get back. So I'm like, well, you know, what's going on? And on the back screen, on the back of them, it says Houston Oilers select Chris Sanders. And I'm like, Mom, they just picked me. She's like, stop lying. Quit playing with my emotions. And then all of a sudden it said, you know how it says, you know, pick is in. And it says Houston select Chris Sanders. And all of a sudden a call comes. Here's Jeff Fisher. Hey, son. You ready to be a Oiler? I could just see the stash through the phone. And I said, yes, sir, I'm ready. And that was when the journey started, when he called me.
So literally, what then happens immediately thereafter, later that evening, the next day, the next week? How does that little process go?
I still had to finish school. I still had to get my degree. So once I finished my degree, I packed up all my things, and then I moved to Houston. And that was the year where the Rockets won. So I went down there. It was already a hoopla. So when I stepped there, I knew that this is business. It's no more fun and games. It's no more, well, if you do good, you do bad, you keep your scholarship. It's about, I got to go win a job, and I got to go be the player that I'm capable of being for the Houston Oilers / Titans.
Mm-hmm. And then at the time, your first quarterback was who again?
It was Chris Chandler. Chris Chandler, and it was me. It was Steve McNair. We got drafted the same year. But Chris Chandler, boy, he fed me the rock, buddy.
Really?
Yeah, he was one of those. It was funny because when I first walked in the building, you know, he wouldn't even speak to me because I was a rookie. I said, how you doing? I even called him Mr. Chandler. I'm like, what are we doing, bud? I said, how you doing? He looked at me and kind of snarled. when we got on that field and he said, hey, big boy can play, he saw me run down. He saw me jumping over people making catches. Then now his tune kind of changed because he knew that, hey, we was about to do something special.
So I'm guessing somewhere along the way, he was kind of looking for you to earn it.
He was looking for me to earn it, but I had to because, you know, we had some good players. They had to run and shoot before I came. Even more Warren was before there.
That's right.
And then they had a great defense. They had Marcus Robertson. They had Blaine Bishop. They had a lot of good secondary. So when I went out to practice, I had to earn my respect. It wasn't like, okay, you went to Ohio State, we're going to give it to you. And I remember the second day of practice, I ran a slant route. And Marcus Robertson, you know, he hit me. You're not supposed to hit in 7-on-7. And he hit me and he stood over me. And back in the day, I was a real hothead. So I stood up after he hit me and I spiked the ball. Right now, I don't say bad words, but back then I said a whole bunch of bad words. And I spiked the ball. I said, you blankety, 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 blank. I'm here all day, baby. And from that day on, I earned their respect.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so tell me this. What was the biggest difference from, let's say, when it relates to the playbook?
Yeah.
Of then learning the Ohio State playbook and then all of a sudden getting an NFL playbook. What was that like?
I don't think the playbook changed. I just think it's different verbiage, but it's still the same. A slant is a slant. The route tree is exactly the same. And when I say route tree, it's like a slant, a hitch, you know, a go route. All that stuff was the same. I just think that the thing that changed for me is I had to understand that I had to be a complete receiver. I can't just be a guy that beat you on a post or beat you on a go route. It's about becoming a complete receiver, understanding how to get the guy off the spot, how to stack him, how to, you know, head fake at the top of the route, burst off the cut, learn all those things that I really didn't know at Ohio State. So once I understood how to master my craft, and once I mastered my craft, and a guy named Les Steckel taught me all that. He's a great man. He taught me how to be a receiver and how to master my craft. And once I mastered that my craft, now my game took off. Because now, instead of just running by you, now I can get your hips locked and I come a different way. And now that's how I win and create separation.
Yes, a lot of people have long since forgotten that Les Steckel was the offensive coordinator when you guys went to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, he did. And he was my receiver coach when he was the first person that I saw when I walked in there. Then in 1999, that's when he became the offensive coordinator. But he taught me how to be a wide receiver. There's a lot of, I studied a lot of receivers in the draft now. Mm-hmm. They're big, they're fast, they're strong. But there's not a lot of receivers in this draft that running routes crisp. Mm-hmm. And when you start running route crisp and master your craft and understand that I can't just beat you with speed, I got to beat you at the line of scrimmage and I got to beat you at the top of the route. And once I do that and understand coverages, now I take my game to a whole different level.
So you were drafted 67th overall. I'm assuming somewhere along the way, especially prior to your rookie year, I'm assuming that you were very concerned and preoccupied with how many wide receivers were picked before you.
Yeah, I still J.J. Stokes, Antonio Freeman. I know those guys.
Well, so that's it. So then I'm also guessing that you were very interested to see like how their careers developed relative to then yours.
You know what's funny? Me and Joey Galloway, he got drafted the first round from the Seattle Seahawks. He went in front of me for Seattle. And there was a lot of receivers in front of me. But, you know, I was a fifth receiver taken. But the funny thing about that, with me and Joey Galloway being roommates, we made the all-rookie team that year. In 1995. He made it for the NFC. I made it for the AFC. And that's kind of weird because we were both good players.
Outstanding. Well, for sure, you were a great player for the longest time. Appreciate and, of course, going back in the day, I for sure cheered for you and the rest of the Titans. So, folks, keep it right here. You're listening to Michaels and Mueller. I've got Chris Sanders right here in studio. And when we come back, we're going to see if maybe we can figure out who the Titans, who Chris Sanders thinks that the Titans are going to pick for the upcoming NFL draft. Folks, keep it right here. Listen to Michaels and Mueller on 104.5 The Zone. All right, folks. We still have a little more to go here on Michaels and Mueller. And Barney Aller, I'm the head golf instructor at the Old Hickory Country Club. And make sure that you tune in tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock for Global Golf Radio, where I'm going to be hosting that show. Ned Michaels is going to be joining us. We're going to talk a lot more about the Masters. But now I've got my good buddy Chris Sanders. He's here in studio. We're talking NFL draft. Yeah. And before we get into talking about what the Titans are going to do, maybe you're predicting that they might pick, one last little thing about you and your draft experience. What advice, now that you're so much older than you used to be back then, what advice would you give to the younger players that are about that their dreams are going to come true next week?
You know, I remember I was talking to Kevin Dyson maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, and he said these words to me. He said, I didn't know my career was going to end that quick.
Really?
And what I would tell these young guys, one play could cost you your career.
And with all due respect, you and Kevin Dyson both, in my eyes, you actually had relatively long careers.
Yeah, and in one play, your career could end. And the advice that I would give these players is, you know, be humble, but play every play like it's your last play. Like it, I mean,
because it might be.
It might be. I would love to go run a route. I would love to catch a ball. I would love to make a touchdown. That's the things that I regret. If I'd have worked a little bit harder, I could have been a little bit better. And I think so much that when we're so much into it, we don't value it until it's gone. So that's one of my advice to say, listen, man, hey, value every play. Love coming to practice. Love catching a jug machine. Listen to the coaches. Be coachable, because one day your career is going to come to an end.
Because also, I have to believe that you're kind of right in the middle of the storm, because you've been in football. You've had a helmet on and pads since childhood. Yeah. And I've got a vision that you're thinking it's going to be like this until I'm 67 or something, when the reality is that's not true at all.
You got to have a vision beyond football. And when I retired from the NFL, I didn't have a vision. So that's why I struggled. I struggled with depression. I struggled with suicidal tendencies, because I was going through so much things because it was taken away from me. It's kind of like this. You ever watch that cartoon Aladdin where he's floating on the carpet? He's floating and everything feels good and everything's cozy. But all of a sudden somebody takes that afraid away from you and you start falling and there's nobody to catch you.
Yep.
So when I retired, it was like the cover was flipped off and I was falling, but there was nobody to catch me. And I want to teach these guys, man, to have a vision beyond football. So that's why I want to coach in the NFL, is I don't want to see these guys just win on the football field. I want to see these guys win in life, because I made a lot of mistakes, a ton of mistakes. And I want to teach these guys not to make the same mistakes I made and help them not just win on the football field, but also win in life.
Because naturally, you've been a part of the NFL for several decades and stuff. And in the NFL fraternity, with what you just said about battling depression and so forth, realistically, what would you say is the percentage of guys that either retire or they're more or less kind of forced out of the league? I'll put the over under on about 90%.
I say 100%.
It's 100%. Now, a little bit of everybody.
See, a lot of guys like Peyton Manning, they automatically go into the radio or the TV. You're still around football,
right?
But what happens to the guy that doesn't have a job to go to football, or he's not coaching football, or he's not on TV? Those are the guys that are struggling, because I didn't work for 2 years when I retired. And that's where the depression and the suicidal and going through a divorce and all these things that I went through, you know, just kind of piled up. And I'm trying to face life and I don't know how to face it. And I'm so glad that I have people around me to help me get out. Number one is my faith that got me out.
But
it's just understanding that you got to have a vision beyond football. Because you know what NFL stands for? It stands for not for long. You're not going to be there for long. So it's having a vision, you know, for football. It's like when I coach football in the league whenever I coach in the NFL, the first thing I would do is I would have with my receivers, I would sit down and I would let them hear my story of what I went through. And then I would have each one of them get up and tell their story. So now if I hear their story, I can help them write their book in life away from football.
And ladies and gentlemen, this is the one and only number 81, Mr. Chris Sanders.
Appreciate
and
you,
I could talk to him all night long, but in the blink of an eye, we're going to run out of time. And if we keep going in this discussion, we're not going to get to hear who he thinks the Titans are going to pick and some of the Titans need. So, Chris, fire away.
All right, here we go. You know the draft is rich in defense, and we need an edge rusher.
Yeah, no kidding.
We got Montee Sweat from Mississippi State, Brian Burns from Florida State, Christian Wilkins from Clemson, Rashard Gary from Michigan, Quinnen Williams from Alabama, Jeffrey Simmons from Mississippi State, Josh Allen from Kentucky, Zach Allen from Boston College. All those guys sound good. They're all fast and big and strong, but there's one guy that I love in this draft.
Here we go.
The first guy that I said was Brian Burns. I love that guy. Fierce, like a Javon Kurse guy. But here's a guy that I think that nobody's really talking about that can fit the Titans scheme, and that's Zach Allen from Boston College. And if you look at Mike Vrabel wants smart players.
Yes.
He wants a player that has a continuous motor.
Yes.
And a guy that's not going to take a playoff. If you look at Zach Allen from Boston College, he's a relentless player. He never takes a playoff. He might not be as athletic as those other guys, but he's going to give you 1,000% every single play. That's the guy that I want on my team.
And if he does join the Titans, I'll tell you what he ought to do.
What's that?
He ought to go to Grove Living, because the Grove out in College Grove, that's where we like to go, because their golf course is gorgeous. And in case you've never been, they've got a swimming pool that I'm telling you, if I'm a 10-year-old kid, I'm sitting there going, Mom and Dad, I'm good. They built a jungle gym with water. And so if he comes over here, That's where he should find his home. And folks, that's where you should find your home too, at Grove Living.
Yes, sir.
Chris, keep going.
And another thing that we probably need, everybody talks about, is wide receivers. The one everybody talks about, DK Metcalf. In my opinion, I don't think he's a good fit. I just think he's a downfield guy that can take the top off the defense. That's exactly what we need, but that's all I can give you. The guy that I like is Parrish Campbell. I love Parrish Campbell from The Ohio State University. He runs those quick screens. He runs those shallow crosses and those deep crosses because that's what Matt LaFleur ran last year. Matt LaFleur is not with us this year, but that's the kind of things that they did. And another guy that I like is Deebo Samuel from South Carolina. He is a beast. Went through adversity, came back, and now he plays with a chip on his shoulder. He's a great route runner, yards after catch, one of those guys that can be beneficial to the Tennessee Titans.
So you were the number 67 overall pick. Did you have a chip on your shoulder?
I had a mad chip. Not a potato chip, but a mad chip. Because everybody was telling me what I couldn't do.
Oh, really?
He can't do this. Oh, he's just a track guy playing football. Let me show you.
Really?
I walked in the second day of practice. There's a veteran. This is when I was a knucklehead. I was a hothead. And the veteran came up to me and said, Chris, you take all the reps. I said, no, man, I just took 3 in a row. He said, I'm a veteran. You tell me what I do. And I walked up straight to him. I said, how about I just take your job? And I did. Took his job. But I had a chip on my desk. And I know that's the wrong way to do it. But I had a chip on my shoulder. You said I can't do it. You said I can't play. You said I can't run routes. Let me show you. And from day one, I'm like, I'm going to crush you. Ask Blaine Bishop. Blaine Bishop said, the first day I covered you, I'm not covering you again, because I was so mad. I was a violent route runner. I'm jumping over 5 people to catch the ball because my chip was on my shoulder because people were saying I couldn't do it. And I said, guess what? I'm not going to prove you wrong, but I'm going to prove it to myself. And I'm going to make every touchdown that I catch. Dang gummit.
So another thing, too, that you happen to have brought up is, well, all these college football players, when they're playing at such a high level, again, among the elite, the reality is a lot of guys, evidently, they're going to come into this draft with some degree of injury.
Yeah.
You had evidently some injuries.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I guess you were able to overcome them and put people in their place.
I just think, you know, and you know, football is a violent sport, and you're going to get hurt. But I think that a lot of teams are looking at how you handle it. If you're constantly getting hurt every single week, then you're not going to be valuable to the team. If you get a nick here and there, or you hurt your knee one year, but then the next 5 years you're healthy, then that's okay. But if you're getting hurt year after year after year after year, you may be a great player, but you're not available. Mm-hmm. And in the NFL, you can be All-American, you can win the Heisman, but if you're not available on the field, it means absolutely nothing. And that's kind of what Mariota's run into now.
Right. You're exactly right. And then, Chris, with the few minutes that we've got left, I want to go ahead and share that, for instance, Mel Kiper and Todd McShay.
Yeah.
I love those two guys, and I think that they are 100% correct when they're talking and glorifying all these different players. And it's really remarkable and impressive the number of people that they know, and again, all sorts of different intangibles. But I got to tell you, I'm going to make a confession to you. When it comes to all these mock drafts, unless you're one of the top 5 picks,
right.
There's no way that any of these mocks draft ever even come close. It's like trying to pick an NCAA bracket. Yeah. It's not even close.
It's not even close. Look at last year. What happened? Everybody thought that what was the quarterback's name from Oklahoma? The quarterback. I just lost my thought. But nobody expected that he was going to get picked first round. Not first round, but first pick. They thought it was somebody, some other quarterback. So it's unpredictable. Nobody knows. Mel Kiper and them, they're great. They have great insight. But they don't know what's going on in the minds of the general manager.
No.
They don't know what's going on in the minds of their head quarterback, because they got to get a guy that fixed their identity of their team, not what you think.
Chris, we've got all about a minute left. Yes. Who else are the Titans looking at?
I think they're going to get maybe an offensive guard. I mean, there's some good offensive guard. There's one from Florida. There's one from Alabama, and they're doggone nasty. And if you get a solid guard, and you put him with Conklin, you put him with LaJuan, you put him with all those guys, then now you went from an okay offensive line to a dominant offense. And that's exactly what Indianapolis Colts did last year.
And folks, you heard it here from Chris Sanders. Thanks so much for being a part of Michaels and Mueller. And folks, keep it right here. Neutral Zone with Christopher Martell and his brother Darren. They're coming up right here. Folks, keep it right here. 104.5 The Zone. And tomorrow night, Global Golf Radio covering the Masters. Have a good evening.